Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, pickles out there, and those of you that do not know what I'm referring to, that is our slang for our four-legged friends. And I'm sure we've got a few tuning in this evening, this afternoon, or this morning.
Yeah, I have no doubt that people make their pets listen to us.
Most definitely.
I hope so.
Sitting across from me, it has to be one of the most loving and endearing blue-haired ladies that I've ever had. The pleasure of spending any sort of time with. Ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, my God.
She comes by many names. Kagi, K-Dog. There's a few that I cannot mention. Ladies and gentlemen, Kagi!
Well, that was lovely. Thank you.
Just
that
off
was
the
a
cuff.
Really nice intro.
It's been a while.
I was waiting for you to say something rude.
About your butt.
Or insult. Well, usually, yeah.
There's nothing rude
yeah.
about your butt, baby.
I mean, last week I think I told everyone about your mole that looks like a carton of West End.
Nice.
So I was expecting a jab.
No, it's all about love today. Friday, knock
that.
Off beers, happy days.
Happy days. It's We're going to need a bit of love and levity in this episode.
Yes,
so I appreciate
third,
that.
This is the third parter of a...
It's the third parter.
Of a third part series.
Three part series, yes it is. We're going to wrap this fucking nightmare up.
Apparently there's a bit to it, so we're not going to linger too long. But before we dive knuckle deep,
yes,
I would
sir.
Like to... like to find out a little bit more about you. We've been together 10 years, and I'm sure there's a few things that I'm unaware of. I'm always learning about you all the time.
About 3 inches.
That's what they reckon is a safe stopping distance or something.
I'm not sure what it was.
No. So,
sure.
If you had the opportunity to choose your last meal.
I love this question. I love to ask people this question.
If you could have, what would your last meal be? Would you dive into the cerebral cortex of your brain, if that's even where this would be stored, and go back to your youth to something that comforts you? Or would you go to something that is more, you know, something that you've eaten of late, or a combination of things that you've never ever put together that you would? So...
Can I have a three-course meal?
That was what I was just about to say
Sorry.
So it's a three-parter.
Oh, cool.
Start from the outside and work your way in.
Okay.
So we've got the cutlery. She's laid out. Silver side up.
Oh.
What would be your entree? That's tough. Because the longer we have time to think of these things, we would choose.
Yeah, it's like when you look at a menu and you pick something and then you keep looking at the menu and you go, actually, maybe I want that. All right, so right off the cuff.
So, yeah. So
the entree would be probably a serve of marin.
And how would you like your marin? So for those of you that don't know,
we've got
our listeners in Kenya even, I think, so they might not know the marin. So it's Australia's largest freshwater crayfish. It's endemic.
Good factoid.
Good factoid. It's endemic. We have talked about marin, I think, a couple of times before because we do love them. It's endemic to the southwest of WA.
It is. It's incredibly important to our waterways.
There's lots of them. And, well, not lots of them, sorry, because some of them are in danger. There's a hairy marin. They're lucky.
I've never seen a hairy marin.
Well, I've only
Can
seen pictures. Yeah, I've seen pictures of a hairy marin. I think they're in danger. You can get blue marin. So they are bred in farms and things like that, but you can get some whoppers. And, they're very nice. So if you like freshwater crustaceans, they're sweeter than a yabby. If you've ever eaten a yabby, yabbies are pretty sweet. They're just really not lots of flesh, lots of meat. They're just very, very desirable. There's that little of them around and that sought after. They have a season that only goes for about in between 2 and 4 weeks. So, they're very nice. You can have them. Yeah, one of the favourite ways to have them is some nice white bread with some salt and pepper, lots of butter. But they are pretty good, and I won't. I'll bring them
around
up
the
in
campfire.
Mine around the campfire.
Yeah,
but certainly they're good. Okay, so how would you like your marin?
Well, you've just said it. I want Baker's Delight high fiber
low GI high
bread.
Fiber Baker's Delight from a
butter.
Shop in Australia that bakes bread. Yes,
butter, salt and pepper.
butter, salt and pepper.
And a nice marin. Thick layer of fresh marin.
Oi, okie dokie. So we're diving straight into a sandwich for entree.
We are. So it's a bold move. Classy. This is going to be a carb-heavy move. I've got to tell you, like, this meal is going to be carb-heavy.
Classy as fuck. Well, you can throw that knife and fork away. Right. Because and this is hands-on.
That's going to be accompanied by a beer.
All right, so we do have three beverages accompanying these foods.
Yes.
Because this was going to be just a little quick intro, but I think that this has the possibility of being fun. So, what sort of beer are you having with your singer?
A Byron Bay Lager. I'm a Byron Lager Bay drinker.
She's a Lager lad. Lager lass?
I am a Lager lass.
Okay, moving right along.
Moving on. Mains. Is a little bit harder because I have two choices in mind.
Ooh.
One is obviously, first and foremost, and it's going to be the winner, is it has to be exactly the same as the spaghetti my mum always made for me growing up. Mum's spaghetti.
Can you make your mum's spaghetti?
Yeah, but not as good as mum does.
No one ever can.
No one ever makes it as good as mum does. Okay. So, mum's spaghetti.
Yep.
Or
the
noodle soup that I used to get in Cambodia when we, from the...
chicken blood.
From the street carts. I used to eat them on the street all the time, this beautiful, like, red curry vermicelli noodle soup that I've tried to replicate here, but without ready access to certain ingredients, I can't make.
Okay.
So it's one of the two. It's probably going to be mum's spaghetti.
Okay, spaghetti is the
accompanied leader. By a whiskey sour.
Oh, whiskey sour.
Followed by...
A burp.
Followed by a pina colada.
Pina colada. Nice. Yes.
And
okay.
Two drinks with my mains because they're going to hang me, so fuck it.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
Sweets is a little bit harder because as I'm getting older, my taste in sweets is changing.
Okay, we're talking right now. This could be a different answer next week.
Maybe a sticky date pudding and custard?
Sticky date and custard. There's no sticky date. A sticky date and sticky date or no sticky date pudding? Because like you get the sticky dates from the shop. There's no sticky date.
I want a handmade sticky date. It's got chunks of dates in it.
Okay. Mm. So a sticky date pudding.
With custard. Yes. And that's going to be served with a glass of Riesling.
Okie dokie, artichoke.
And hopefully by that point I'll be drunk enough to not worry too much about
Well, we didn't talk about that because it's just your last meal. This could be just your last meal and then you end up, I don't know.
It could have just been a bottle of Jack's, really.
Bottle of Jack's, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so that's my last meal. All right. Do you want to do yours or do you want to do yours next week? Because we've already eaten up like almost 10 minutes.
We'll do my last meal next week.
All right, that sounds amazing.
We'll keep him on some tender hooks. We'll keep him hanging. Absolutely.
Call it the juicy dangler.
Give the juicy dangler. Give the punters something to tune in on, punt on next time.
I'm pretty sure I know what it is. But, I mean, I'm your wife and have known you for 10 years and been with you for 10 years. So if I didn't know what it was... That would be pretty shit.
Calling pig's ass on that. Like,
that would be shit whiffery.
No, I'm not having it.
It's like midwifery, but it's not great.
No.
Okay.
The other side.
Exactly. It's the other.
It's the other. Well,
it's only a few inches away,
but
yeah, exactly.
Shit whiffery.
Yeah. Looking up.
I have to go to school for as long, I would say.
So are you ready?
To become a shit whifferist.
Are you going to be stuck on shit whiffery for the whole whifferist? Episode? Oh my
it's kind
God.
Of my new dream job.
Here I am trying to tell you a horrific story. Just stuck on shit whiffery. Quick FYI, it's fucking cold here, so the heat is running in the background. Yeah. You're probably going to hear it a little bit. I apologize, but it was either that or be really cold. So, I mean.
We'll kick it back.
We apologize. Okay, so welcome back. It's part 3 of our deep dive into Eric Edgar Cook. Things got a little bit dark in the last episode, Bluey, and if I'm honest, it's not really going to lighten up much this week. In fact, I think you're probably going to be a bit traumatised by some of the things that I've got to tell you.
Okay,
it's not the first time I've traumatised you, but it's and it won't be the last.
This won't be on purpose, though.
No. So as always, proceed with caution. You know the drill. I've told you a few times now. Without further ado, let's wrap this shit up.
Boom, boom.
Oh, boom, 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 boom. Don't do us.
I was thinking about doing some beatboxing and the whole boom, boom. Not that I have ever been able to beatbox, but didn't seem to be something. It should have been at the end. Sorry, I should have been a little bit more.
We can come back to the beatboxing.
Bit more upbeat and.
Yeah, maybe.
Boots in.
Yeah, don't start a beatbox with boom, boom.
No, it's only the finale. Not the,
I think so.
Not that I'm attuned in the beatboxing world.
You're not a professional beatboxer?
No.
Okay. So, when we left Eric Edgar Cook, He was in full throes of bloodlust, having been on a killing spree on Australia Day in 1963. And Perth is terrified. Do you remember this boy? He tried to shoot the two people in the car, and yes. when he failed, he shot the woman in the wrist. And when he failed, he went into like a rage-fueled shooting spree.
Yep.
And just wreaked some general fucking havoc and killed a heap of innocent
people. Having a good time. He's having.
He was having a good having time. His, fuck all else.
He's having his equivalent of a great night.
Yes.
He's probably like been working up to it, mm-hmm. doing all these bits of deviantness and these horrible things one at a time, and he kind of went, you know, it'd be really good if I just shot did it all everyone. Up in the same night and just fuck some shit up. And got it all out of my system. Try to get a week's worth of skullduggery done in a crack. Just for night.
Thank you for that insight into the serial mind, Bluey. We appreciate it.
Yes.
I'm sure our listeners do.
No worries.
I liked it.
Thank you.
You can feel free to do insights like that whenever you want.
I'm here a week.
Well, you live here, so yes. So it's really not long before he's at it again. In fact, it's only about 2 weeks after the Australia Day murders. He's kind of been, you know, not really willing to sit on it for too long this time. During this period, there'd been a manhunt for an unrelated criminal who had shot and killed a cop.
Yes.
So Cook feels the heat is off him a little bit, and he can go about his usual business.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, they're looking for that guy. They're not looking for me anymore. I just shot fucking everyone in Perth. Yeah. But who cares?
That's right.
Right. So he steals a car, and he decides he feels like running some people over. I mean, we've all been there. He attempts to hit these people on the Vespa, but another car turns into the street, and so he kind of, like, leaves them alone.
Didn't want to put on a show.
He's got a witness then. So he then finds Rosemary Anderson, age 17, walking alone. Rosemary was headed home after arguing with her partner, John Button. John becomes pretty integral to the story. John's 19. John had jumped into the car to get after Rosemary when she had stormed off, but she refused to get in. You're 19 and 17, so it's shitty little fights that you have with your partner, and it's really
stand your ground.
Stupid. Yeah, but no.
Stand your ground. I'm not having none of it. I'm not getting in your car.
No, absolutely not. So there's some drama going on. So he sort of drives his car away, and he stops to have a cigarette and allows them both time to cool off. Then he attempts to go and talk to her again. Gets in his car, goes looking for her. During that time, though, Cook had spotted our Rosemary.
Rose.
He chased her down and he hit her.
Look behind you, Rose.
Too late. John is driving up the street looking for her when he sees a pile of something on the road. It's maybe rags or something like that. He thinks a bit of Rose. Stuff. He's not quite sure, but it's sus, I suppose, because eventually he gets out of the car and he goes over to find Rosemary lying in the dirt covered in blood.
She's been nailed.
Unresponsive. So poor dudes have this fucking dumb argument, which, you know, couples do, not us, other couples.
She wasn't such a prick, she would be fine.
Exactly. No, we're not blaming John. We are not blaming John.
Not blaming John?
No.
Okay.
Are you going to get enough of that? And now he's picking her up off the road to put her in the back of his car and get her to the hospital. Little does he know that three men are watching him struggle with Rosemary's limp body. These men watch him and think, what if this guy is the Australia Day killer?
Oh, John.
They watch John finally get her in the car and they follow him as he drives to a nearby doctor's surgery, where they realise their mistake and they try and help John. He tells him it's fine, he's got it. Doctor comes out, they get her inside, where the doctor tells John that there's nothing he can do here. The doctor calls an ambulance, probably just call an ambulance in the first place next time. And the police, so he calls an ambulance and the police. He cleans the blood from Rosemary's mouth and tries to keep her breathing.
Yep.
Meanwhile, Cook has slammed the stolen car into a tree to try and cover the damage caused by Rosemary's body. The police are pretty keen to talk to John. He seems dazed and nervous, which I suppose he would be. He's only a kid, and that's a pretty traumatic thing that he's just gone through.
Had a fight with his chicky babe and found her all fucked up on the side of the road. And
fucking awful.
Then had to do the scoopy scoop out of her mouth to keep her breathing.
It's awful. It would have been rough. Dreadful. So he tells the police that they'd had a fight and that then he finds her body, but they aren't convinced. And they notice a couple of tiny dents in John's car. What 19-year-old doesn't have dents in his car? for fuck's sake.
Boring ones.
So, of course, the police develop a theory. We're not advocating dangerous driving.
Certainly not.
So, of course, the police develop a theory and they take him back to the police station where he's questioned over and over all night long. They refuse to tell him anything about Rosemary's condition. Eventually, he writes a written statement many, many hours later. But the police don't believe his story, and the questioning continues. It's that sort of old story that we hear a little bit in true crime of a policeman or a police officer deciding that something's happened a specific way and refusing to accept any other version of that story. It does biased happen in some of these stories. They get kind of blinkers on sometimes. This is a very broad, generalized statement. It's just something we see sometimes in true crime stories.
A little bit old school, foot up on the stool, diary hanging out of the gob.
Yeah.
It would have been, yeah. It probably smacked.
Now look here, see?
Yeah, smacked him around with the old yellow pages.
I'm sure there was some of that. Apparently his treatment was pretty rough.
Yeah, gave him a few in the ribs with the yellow pages and, yeah, a bit of sleep deprivation and dehydration.
Apparently he was there, like he had no shoes on. He was, he was there like all night.
Got the battery out.
Yeah, it's fucking terrible. Finally, after an entire night of begging to know if Rosemary was okay, a police officer walks up to John and simply says, "I have to inform you that Rosemary's dead," and walks away. There's not a lot of compassion there.
Wow, no.
So while John had been in the cop shop, Rosemary has been fighting for her life. She had sustained injuries to her face, which included a cut the length of her eyebrow, which bled profusely. Head and face wounds do that. Hey, they fucking drip. Yep. Like, this was seen as the likely cause for the blood evidence at the scene. She had several other wounds to her face, forearms, hands, and fingers, as well as large abrasions to her thighs, knees and toes.
10 points.
Just beat up all over the poor fucking thing. Her fibula was fractured. Pop quiz, Dr. Bluey. Where is the fibula?
Well, you've got a tibia and fibula. Mm. A tibia as in your lower leg.
Probably.
Yeah. So I thought it was your arm, but your arm's your radius and ulna. And your
humerus.
Tibia and fibula, I think, is in your leg. But I could be wrong because I'm a couple of stubbies in.
I mean,
tibia and fibula.
Again, I've done that thing where I've asked you a question, but I didn't look up the answer.
Oh, that's okay.
But
that's
I'm pretty sure you're right.
Because what I don't know.
But do you know why they call your elbow your funny bone?
Please tell me if you
because
know
because it's the end of your humerus.
Well,
I mean, that's pretty good, right?
That is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Because that
that's
is
probably
me.
My favorite fact.
Oh, I could fucking die happy now. That is a question that I've never known the answer to and has come up after quite a number of...
Because everyone hits their funny bone and goes, why do they call it that? It's not fucking
yeah,
funny.
Yeah, but it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Oh, it's always the last place to look.
Didn't I?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Mm.
Thank you for teaching me that.
That's
I shall
okay.
share that quite liberally.
All right, so that was a little, like, sidestep. Are you looking up the fibula first?
Yes. Yeah, I was correct. The tibia and fibula. So your tibia is sort of like your main bone at the front of your leg.
Uh-huh.
You can probably feel below your knee. And your fibula.
It's like your shin bone.
Your fibula is a little bugger that just goes on the outside of that. Is it on the outside?
There you go. So
yeah,
she broke that fucker. Or he broke that
fucker.
Yeah,
which is it's a lot smaller. The fibula's a smaller bone.
Yeah. Poor Rosemary.
Supporting act. Yeah, no, pretty rough.
Yeah, it's awful. So poor Rosemary had suffered a large bleed in between her brain and the tissue that covers the brain, you know,
yes.
that like membrane, which is not good. You don't want bleeding in there.
No.
That's not ideal.
Nope.
She had this all over the entirety of her brain,
yeah,
not just in one place. She had severe bruising to her temporal lobe. She's got a torn liver.
Jesus, they don't make cars like they used to.
Not fucking ideal. No, that's true.
You get hit by a Prius and what do you...
Oh,
sue them because you got a blister.
That's right. She has hemorrhages to her kidneys and spleen and her abdominal cavity filled with blood.
Yeah, wow. Jesus.
He'd given her a fucking hard tap. She's 17.
Yeah, poor bugger.
That's just tragic.
And died angry.
Oh, I would have... Yeah. Oh, my God. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, she died angry.
Oh, Rosemary. The doctors had finally managed to stabilize her, and they'd given her a transfusion. When she was starting to, like, be okay, she just suddenly crashed and died.
Very sad.
It's really sad. Yeah. A whole last hour before anyone bothers to tell John.
Yeah. He was a number one suspect.
He was a number one. To be fair, he's a number one suspect, but I feel for him. It's dreadful. So he freaks out, naturally. He runs to the bathroom and vomits for a little bit. And then when he returns, he's completely crushed. And in his fucked up state, he tells the police, "I'll tell you what you want to hear. I'll confess to her murder."
And oh, wow. Jeez, you can get anything out of people.
Fucking sad is this shit, hey?
People tell you anything if you give them enough time.
Oh, it's been proven that, like, you put the right amount of pressure on someone, you torture them or make them go without food or whatever, they're going to tell you whatever you want to hear just to get out of that situation.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's just human nature.
And I've been in a position like that as a kid. We don't need to go into that now. When I went to a Catholic school.
Mm.
And, yeah, I got in trouble and the only way to do was lie about it.
Yeah.
So, I did the thing they told me I did.
And just to get out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to get out of the office. Yeah.
So he just wants to tell them what they want to hear so that he can get out of there and go and be by Rosemary's bedside, which is sadly a pretty common occurrence. He does write another written statement claiming that he had, quote, gotten fresh and Rosemary had stormed off. He then said that he had been trying to scare her and he accidentally hit her.
Awesome. I tell you what, we can make some shit up when we need to.
Oh, we're pretty inventive.
Yeah, he didn't even do it in his bloody own life.
The police accept this confession and he's charged with willful murder and he's sent to solitary confinement at Fremantle Prison until his trial a few months later.
Wow.
Freo Prison was open for fucking like a really long time.
Yeah.
Fast forward to April 29, 1963, and John Button's trial is set to start. His family are super supportive and they know he's innocent, so they managed to get him a dope as fuck lawyer named Ken Hatfield. Howdy. Remember that name, it's important.
The Hat Man.
Ken is not initially, don't fucking talk shit about the Hat Man.
No, really. I'm just like, I think it's a cute pet name.
It's not. No. Have you never heard of the Hat Man? We're going to talk about the Hat Man another time. Not right now. That's a whole other episode.
Are you talking about John Hatfield?
No.
Oh.
We don't talk about the Hat Man.
So Hat Man's something totally different.
We've said it too many times. Stop saying
it. All right. So you say it seven times, he appears and bludgeons you to death. Hat Man.
No, stop it. Stop it. Ken is not initially believing John's innocence, mostly because of the confession, so he advises him to take a deal and a 10-year sentence for manslaughter as opposed to the death penalty, which is still in use in WA at this time.
Happening.
Stop that. John refuses. You're making me nervous. John refuses, and this kind of swings Ken to believing that he didn't do it. So Ken's on board. Let's do this. The trial actually only lasts about 8 days, which is pretty short. Ken opens by requesting the judge rule that the prosecution can't bring up the confession in the opening statement as they want to argue that the confession wasn't given willingly, so it can't be used as evidence.
Fair enough.
Louis, you're a federal lawyer, aren't you?
Well, not really, but I will give you the advice that you're looking for.
Does that sound like it's on the up and up?
No.
It sounds off to me. Like, yeah, okay, anyway.
What's on the up and up?
Just them saying, like, trying to make the judge rule that the prosecution can't bring up their key piece of evidence.
Well, because the
defense wants to say that that wasn't real. I don't know. I just don't really know enough about law. I suppose. Well, of course they can. That's why I was asking you.
Yeah. Well, not that I have watched a few Law and Orders in me time.
Yes, you have.
But it's been a while. But no, well, obviously, if you get yourself a lawyer and your lawyer says, tell me about how this evidence that you've told them, that your description of what happened, how do they get that? And he'd say, well, since then I've had a good night's sleep and something to eat and a shit. So I can say now, because I'm not struggling, that they kept me in this room with lights on for like so many hours and, didn't believe I gave them this confession of what actually happened. What I told them what happened. They would believe me and pressured me into telling them what they wanted to, and I wasn't going to. And then they told me she died and it was my world broke. And what was the point of anything? So I just told them what they wanted to hear just so I could go home.
Exactly.
So they would be using that to try and not have that as evidence.
I'm sorry, that was haunting, that monologue. It was lovely.
Sorry.
It was very impressive. Yeah. You should take to the stage. All right, anyway, thank you for that insight. So the judge is cool with that. Questionable evidence can't be used in an opening statement.
No.
So when you put it like that, it makes sense. Or when you put it how you put it. However, the prosecution uses a bit of a kind of a workaround by painting this kind of picture that looks pretty bad for John.
Yeah.
Called to the stand to give testimony, we have the medical staff that tended Rosemary when she went to the hospital and the bloke that did her autopsy. They give evidence to the condition that she was in on arrival. Next up is evidence is given about John's car by police who had it analysed. They say that there was a bit of denting in the car and a depression about 20 centimetres long, but it was only shallow. Just a little ding in the bonnet, not super consistent with the damage Rosemary had suffered. The forensic team had found a couple of microscopic dots of blood on the bonnet, but literally microscopic. It's pretty obvious to us now that that's not the car that hit her.
Okay.
John's father stated that he had seen damage to John's car because John had had a bingle. A bingle, what a great word.
Bingle.
A little while previously. However, he also said that some of it was new to him and he hadn't noticed it before Rosemary died. Because you've got to be honest, you can't rely on the stand. Not even for your kid. The police inspector had even said on the stand, however, that there was no significant damage to the car to indicate that the car was involved in a hit and run. Look, I'm not going to give you any more of a play-by-play this trial. There's plenty of information on the internet about it and in books and stuff like that.
Yeah. So what we know, the trial went for 9 days. They threw out the original witness, the original signed testimony.
They weren't allowed to bring it up because in the opening statements because it was questionable.
Because it was questionable.
Yeah.
And then the forensics of the car wasn't substantial enough to be...
Yeah, exactly.
The weapon that killed her.
So we're getting a pretty good concept of the case that we've got. John is found guilty of manslaughter.
Motherfucker!
And sentenced to 10 years in prison with hard labour.
Jiminy, I tell you what, there would have been some... that jury.
It's bullshit, hey. It's fucking
some jury
bullshit.
Tampering going on there.
I feel like a lot of that would have been like...
Hell, wear and hair up.
Emotional reaction, do you know what I mean? Like the... They went into pretty deep detail about the damage that Rosemary had
suffered to
her body.
Yeah, everyone on that jury probably had a daughter.
Yeah, exactly. So whilst this has all been going on, Eric is still out on the prowl. A few weeks after Rosemary's death, it's a hot as fuck night when he happens upon the house of Jennifer Hurst and Lucy Madrill.
Yep.
Unknown to them, Cook has broken into their house 3 weeks earlier. Mm. Not much info on that is available, though. But what we do know is that on this night, the front window of the house is open. However, Cook goes around the back to avoid being seen from the road.
Oh, backdoor bandit.
He goes into... I can't say that anymore.
Sorry.
I'm cutting that.
Why can't you say it?
You cannot say that. He goes
it ticks into... the boxes, love.
He goes into Jennifer's room first and he looks for her. Looks at her sleeping. Then he heads to Lucy's room. Lucy is sleeping in a sheer 90 on top of the bed. He starts heading towards her, but as he's crossing the room, he kind of like knocks a photo of her on her nightstand, waking her up. Lucy tries to get up and run away, but Cook punches her in the head so hard that her head hits the wall behind her bed. She tries to scream, but he grabs her around the throat in a chokehold, pulls her off the bed and drags her into the spare room that he'd passed on the way up the hall.
This guy's an absolute
killing
machine.
This is going to get pretty bad.
Okay.
Just heads up.
My seatbelt on.
There's a mattress on the floor there, and he throws her onto it, grabs a cord from a nearby lamp, wrapping it around her neck, and strangles her to death. Side note, this is how I first heard of Cook when I was quite young. This is the murder
lamp.
I first heard of.
Yeah, 60s lamp. Those cords weren't as supple as they are now.
No, we have
supple lamp cords on our lamps, but back then they would have been brittle, hard plastic. It would have been dire straits.
Are you ready?
Sorry. 4.
He then rapes her dead body.
Oh, bit of necrophilia.
pause here for a vomit break.
All righty.
After this, he decides that he's not done. He drags her body down the stairs and out into a laneway. He struggles a bit because he wasn't a very big dude. He was kind of on the small side. As he's dragging Lucy's body and kind of struggling with it, Lucy's cat sees him and attacks him and, like, scratches the fuck out of him.
That's cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. I like that.
Kill a cat.
He gets Lucy's body to the house that's behind hers. It's a large mansion owned by a very wealthy family called the Nobles.
I wonder if they were noble.
It's there that he dumps her body under the washing line.
Okay, that sounds weird.
Okay.
There's a few scenes, though. There's a few, the bedroom.
There's a few stages.
The spare room. The street. Like, it wouldn't have been, if he's only a little bastard, he would have been, it would have been hard going. Like, no. Why would you bother?
It was a lot of work.
It's not lazy.
No. So, I'm going to tell you something supremely fucked up.
Okay.
If the rape of her corpse was a bit much for you, maybe go to your happy place for like 30 seconds. I'm really sorry I have to say this.
Okay.
Cook finds an empty whiskey bottle nearby.
Okay.
Which he inserts into Lucy. Fuck. I'm so sorry. I have to tell you this. I'm sorry.
What?
It's horrible. He then removes it and leaves it next to her body, kind of under her armpit. Do you need a break? Do you want to talk about something else for a second?
What?
Why don't you go and give Pickle a scratch behind
the
ears?
I need another beer. I'll go get another.
All right. Let's have a little beer break right now. Fuck. We'll be back.
All right. We've had a little break.
Had a break.
We're back.
We had a shot.
We had a shot.
We
cracked another stubby. Mm. And I would just like to, for the record.
Yeah.
We're doing this for fun, love. What's going on there?
As I was writing it, I was like, what kind of hobby is this?
God.
I know. I'm sorry.
I wonder if beers are tax deductible.
Okay, look. So that's it for poor Lucy.
All right. Poor love.
He leaves her there to be discovered by the homeowners the next morning. As a homeowner, Bluey, doesn't that sound like your literal fucking nightmare?
Well, recently, yes, but this guy has, he doesn't only want to obviously inflict pain or destruction on other individuals.
Yeah.
But he wants to obviously, I don't know what I'm talking about, but he sounds like he has experienced the full gamut of whatever's going on and really submersing himself. He's not just doing what he's got to do and then fucking off. He's sticking about and then getting to involve other people. So not only is he didn't just destroy that young lass's world, he's destroyed her family's, her family. And not just because she has died, which is tragic, but for them to know what's happened to her, you know, that is so much fucking worse.
Oh, it's true.
I think. And then also for where he left the body.
I feel like there's a humiliation aspect
at the
in this one.
Bingles. Was it the Bingles?
The Nobles.
The Nobles. Mm. They live next door to the Bingles. Sorry, I always mix those two up. So he left the body of the Nobles under the clothesline. Mm. So it's going to have quite a big effect on that fan.
It affects everyone. Yeah, absolutely. You're right. You're
so
totally
not,
right.
It's not like he's squashing.
He's just fucking shit up.
Wow.
It's really, yeah, you're right. All right.
Okay, okay.
So police are confused as fuck about this murder. All this shit happened while Jennifer slept. She never heard anything. So they know that this guy is experienced. And they know that a prowler has been reported a lot in the neighborhood. However, they get their first evidence in this case because
semen was left behind.
The whiskey bottle had traces of semen on top of it. I'm sorry. I won't bring it up again.
Oh, okay. Thanks. I understand why you had to tell us about the whiskey bottle to start with.
That's the only... Yeah, that's why I included it. Otherwise, I would have just been like, he desecrated it. Like,
jizz on a bottle. All right. I understand why you had to tell us about the bottle and then they found semen.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no, it's part of it, but I'm going to have to call my therapist.
That's fine. Can you call one for me, please?
Yeah. Holy macaroni.
So they take the whiskey bottle to London, where there's just been opened up a whiz-bang new forensic lab that can actually allow them to get the blood type from the semen. I mean, it's not that impressive now because we have more than that, But in the 60s, that's an amazing leap forward. Mm. We only have what we have now because of the innovations happening at the time. So the forensic examiner takes the bottle himself in a briefcase to London. Doesn't post that shit. He fucking accompanies it to London to get it tested.
Well, that's pretty baller.
It's pretty baller. Yeah. This would be a great movie without some of the specifics involved.
Definitely.
Sadly, the results come back inconclusive. Okay. So I wasn't able to find anything on this, but I mean, I'm not an expert or anything like that, but I think what this means is it's possible that Cook is what they call a non-secretor, which means that his blood antigens won't be in his bodily fluids.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
The perfect crime.
Well, he doesn't know that he's a non-secretor. So you've got secretors and non-secretors.
Yep.
Secretors literally secrete their blood antigens into their bodily fluids, their spit, their semen, stuff like that. Their mucuses and stuff like that.
I'm learning so much. Would you need to get a medical alert bracelet for?
No, it's not
such a thing.
No. Okay. It doesn't affect you physically. It's not like you're alert, it doesn't have a medical effect on you. It's just affects samples.
Okay.
So if they can say he's a secretor, we have his DNA.
That's a great name for a superhero.
The secretor. Oh my god! I beg to differ.
All right, maybe a supervillain.
Maybe.
Marvel, back off.
Oh, no, it's the secretor. Oh, my God, I hate it.
Jesus, just take it away.
Anyway, I don't know if that's the case, but it's the speculation.
Yes.
You know I love to speculate.
Do you think the secretor and the non-secretor would be like arch nemesis?
Yes, I do. Which one is the good guy? Sorry, guys, you're just going to have to bear with us.
I want to think the non-secretor, but if this dude's a non-secretor... Definitely think the non-secretor is a bad guy.
The non-secretor,
because he like doesn't leave a trace, and the secretor leaves. Oh, so the secretor is like a snail. Wherever he goes, you can see. He has
nothing to hide.
Yeah, he's got nothing to hide. He's laying it all out there. Wherever he goes, he's secreting everywhere.
Am I crazy?
The non-secretor, and so they battle.
Yeah. Am I crazy? Should we write this comic book?
Maybe we should. Maybe we should do this.
So after this, Cook spends most of the year breaking into houses, pinching a bit of money here and there. He's kind of filled his tank for murder for a little bit.
Yep.
So he's cashed up and he's loving the atmosphere in Perth. It's a vibe. People are fucking terrified and it makes him feel powerful.
Yeah, because he's not powerful. He knows why they're terrified.
Well, they're terrified of him.
But they don't know that.
He's never felt powerful in his life. If you remember back, I told you about his childhood and he was always bullied and
he was beaten up a lot
and he had a really fucking rough childhood
as a small person.
And now he's
got a swagger about him.
Perth is terrified of him.
Yeah.
There's a lot of power in that for him. He's loving it.
Jesus.
At one point, he just walks into a house where a woman's cooking dinner one night for her kids. He literally just walks in, ballsy as fuck. And she's like,
who the fuck are you?
Fuck are you doing here? She didn't say that. It's the 60s. She would have said, hello, sir. He starts asking her questions about her kids and about herself. It just asked her questions, sort of standing in her fucking kitchen talking to her. She has amazing self-preservation skills. She stays calm. She answers his questions kind of vaguely and broadly. And just as suddenly as he arrives, he gets bored and leaves. The fuck? That's a nightmare.
She's definitely...
She never didn't lock her door again.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Did she do anything about this?
Oh, well, she reported it.
Okay. Sketch artist?
I don't believe so, no. Not that I could read. She might have, but I didn't find anything about that. I just found this case.
Definitely the 60s.
Might have done, because they knew that it was him.
Okay.
So maybe she identified
him. Unless at the end of this episode you tell us the outcome, things might have been worked backwards and pieced together, I dare say.
They could have been. Mm.
But back then they didn't lock their doors. Like, you know.
They didn't. They didn't lock their doors.
Well, my parents don't lock their fucking door now. They live in the country and it's 2023. They might lock it when they go away, but they certainly don't lock it when they're there. Maybe at night time, but not during the day. Mm-hmm. You know, so growing up, we never locked our door. We didn't need a house key. Well, we'd get home from school. We didn't need a house key because the house was never locked.
I used to live in the country on a fucking farm, and I used to leave the door open when I go out. How else is the dog going to get in? And
didn't even have a door. Take it off the
end. Just take the fucking thing off. You don't even need it.
You don't need that thing. You need a fly screen. Keep the flies out. in the summertime. You don't need a door.
So he does get he does get caught a few times breaking into people's places at this point. Though, because people are starting to be aware of their security, they're really scared and they're starting to take steps to protect themselves. It's getting a little bit harder for them. People are locking their doors. Blokes are like keeping their guns next to their beds. Like people are being a bit more aware. They're looking out their windows. They're just starting to be aware.
Well,
because they're scared.
Well, if that sort of stuff was going on around in SA, where we're living, you know, you would definitely be like watching every dodgy dude getting about, and you'd be profiling as you go through. Well, we do that anyway. I suppose everyone does that. Yeah. But we'd be more attuned to such things.
We would. In June, he breaks into the house of Carmel Reed. She hears a noise and she calls out, "Is anyone there?" She can see the faint silhouette of a man at the end of her bed. So now I can never sleep again.
Get a dog.
The fuck is she going to do?
She's snoring.
Literally.
Yeah.
He shines a torch in her face so that she can't see his, and then proceeds to stab her with the tip of a fucking umbrella.
He's resourceful.
He's enjoying himself way too fucking much, this guy.
Yeah, why would you use... Because it hurts more, I guess.
She tries to get away by throwing the blankets over him, which is fucking genius.
Yeah.
That's quick thinking.
Did you punch him, donkey?
He swings to punch her, but Carmel doesn't go down because she's a hard bitch. She runs into her roommate Trisha's room and Cook runs out of the house. The police are called, but there's nothing to go on. There's no prints, there's no description, they can't do shit. But Carmel's a bad bitch.
Come on, Carmel.
Right. 2 months go by.
2 months.
And now we are going to talk about Cook's last murder.
Okie dokie.
But if you're feeling that, like, wave of relief, you're starting to feel happy, it's the last one, we're almost done, just put a pin in that.
It's a setup, folks.
It's just hang on to that feeling if you can.
There's not a Zambuca bottle in this one, is there?
No. Oh, my God. August 10, 1963. Shirley MacLeod, a science student at the University of WA and part-time babysitter, is in a house watching an eight-month-old baby while his parents are out on a stormy night. Isn't that the opening of a fucking movie?
Yeah.
She's sitting on the couch studying when Cook enters the house. He'd been out having a grand time, prowling, breaking and entering, very near the area where he'd committed the Australia Day shootings, which I suspect was pretty exciting for him. There was a lot of cops around that area looking for, like, you know, exactly him. He'd busted into a house with a woman in it, but he was enjoying the risk of being caught. So he sneaks around her house with her unaware. That chills me.
She's just
living her life and he's creeping around her house.
That's why I'm happy we've got a small house, love.
It's beautiful.
Like, no one can walk around this.
It takes me no time to clean, and if anyone's in it, I fucking know.
Yep. And there's no one to live in the roof. We've checked.
There's no one in the roof. That was a real fucking paranoia of mine for a little bit there.
Yeah.
Well, I found a banana missing from the fruit bowl one day, and I fucking convinced myself there was someone living in the roof. Really? Yeah.
Wow.
God damn. I didn't tell you this. No, because you think I'm crazy.
No, I don't think you're crazy.
Just paranoid?
Yeah.
Anyway. So he finds a .22 caliber rifle in this house and he leaves to go and find a victim. He's ready. He sees a woman coming out of a house and enters a park. She's running after a dog.
All right, so he's left the babysitter's house?
No, he's left. So this is another woman's house.
Okay, so he's walked around her house. And
he's broken into someone's house.
Yep.
And he's walking around and he finds a gun.
Okay, and then he buggers off.
So, for some reason, he doesn't kill that woman.
Yeah.
He leaves and goes to find a victim.
Yeah, okay.
He sees a woman coming out of a house and entering a park. She's running after a dog who'd gotten out.
Is he classified as a serial killer, this guy?
Yeah, he is, yeah.
But don't serial killers have to have...
three or more victims.
Yeah, but don't they have to be of, like, similar reasoning behind killing them?
So generally, the modus operandi is the same.
Modus operandi?
But it's not a rule.
Jesus.
Yeah, I listen to a lot of true crime. I
should be wearing my glasses for this.
Yes, you should.
No.
So the MO is generally the same. Yes. But that's not a rule.
So if you kill more than three people, you're a serial killer.
If you're a person that kills more than three people, you're a serial killer.
Yeah, yes. Okay. That's, but you don't have to kill like three people the same way. Or
doesn't have to be the same way. Doesn't have to be the same night. Doesn't have to be the same MO.
Yeah,
it's just three or more people and you're a serial killer. Usually they'll use MO to link crimes together.
Yeah.
Because it's more common that a serial killer will use the same MO, but it's not necessarily always the way.
Yeah, well.
There's always exceptions to the rule. So he goes after this woman. She's chasing her dog into the park. It got out. He tries to aim at her and he's going to shoot her, but he can't get a shot. She sort of moves out of the way because she's chasing her dog. She's nimble. She's chasing her dog. You're nimble when you're chasing the pickle. I know.
I've never been nimble.
You're a very graceful person.
I've never been nimble. And I'm graceful because I get around slow. I'm a big fella. You know, I don't rush too much. I just do me thing. But nimble is not one thing anybody's ever said about. Anyway, continue.
Anyway, so he gets frustrated and he leaves, goes to find another victim. Eventually he ends up in this living room with our young Shirley. She doesn't know that he's there, obviously. She's studying. She's sitting. She's a good girl. She's reading her books. He raises the rifle and fires a single shot into her head. When the homeowners return that evening, they think Shirley's fallen asleep, sitting up on the lounge.
Oh, wow. What a shot.
Yeah. The father goes over to put his hand on her shoulder and wake her up. And he sees the blood.
Oh, wow.
She's still holding her pen in her hand.
Wow.
And is mid-sentence in her note-taking.
Wow. Do you know what sentence it was?
No, I don't. Well, she's studying. She's a student.
Yes.
So it's notes she's writing from a book for the future that she wants to have. So she's
mid-sentence, pen still in her hand. Fuck,
that's depressing.
Wow. Yep.
It's so sad. It's just tragic, isn't it? The couple fear that the killer might still be in the house. So they run up the stairs to the baby's room to check on the baby and they lock themselves in there for a little bit with it.
Oh, really? That's weird. I find that hard to do.
What would you do? You're not going to go looking for him.
Fucking oath. You'd go to the room, make sure the fucking kids... You wouldn't go
and check on your baby?
You'd go to make sure the kid's all right.
Yeah.
You get your wife and the kid, the lock, check, make sure everything's locked down, maybe put the bed up against the window, do whatever you had to do to secure everything. Hopefully it was on the second story, so unlikely someone's up there.
I'd hit that motherfucker with a chair.
And then you'd go looking for him.
I don't want you to do that.
He's only little.
He's got a gun.
He's got a gun, but just remember, you're looking for a dude that's with a gun, so you're going to be pretty fucking nimble.
You've just told me you've never been nimble.
I'd get shot. But I'd dead set have a crack and you'd get out and have a look. You'd have to. You're not going to lock yourself in a fucking room. Well, sorry, you might.
I disagree. I think that they did the smart thing.
Yeah.
Because they survive.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
After a short time, they feel that it's safe and they call, they go and go outside, they get the phone, they call the police. This shooting is actually linked to the Australia Day shootings.
Oh, wow.
And the investigation is massive. Over 8,000 people are interviewed and they find a fucking fingerprint in the house.
They find a fingerprint in that house? They
fucking find a fingerprint.
Yeah, wow.
Everyone that had been in that house is fingerprinted and no one is a match.
No one's a match. It's good news.
The only fucking fingerprint they ever find.
I wonder where they found it.
Well, I never checked, but that's a good question.
Yeah.
The 16th of August, 1963, an elderly couple are out for a stroll in the afternoon. The lady stops to pick flowers on the roadside. Wholesome as fuck.
Idyllic.
They're startled to find a rifle stashed under the bushes.
Ah.
They leave it there. Smart, actually. Go home and report that shit to the local police. If you find a gun in the bushes, don't fucking touch it. It could be a murder weapon. Now it's got your fingerprints on it. Bam! You're doing 5 to life. If you get 5, you're pretty lucky, really.
5, anyway.
I just picked a number.
That's okay.
5 minutes later, that's probably where I got 5 from.
Yep.
The house is full of cops asking to be taken to the location of the gun, which they go back to and they compare the bullets in the gun and the one in Shirley's head.
Yes.
And bingo bango, it's a match. It's thought by the police that because of where and how the gun was stashed, the killer had intended to return it. So they put it back and they set up a trap.
Oh, like it.
I want to see this movie.
They set up a sting.
So they secure it in place with fishing line and they set up some surveillance. And they don't have to wait too long, fortunately. August 31st, Cook is prowling and doing his usual shit, waiting for the dark to retrieve his rifle.
Yeah.
He parks directly opposite the bush. Immediately, he grabs the police's attention. One of them's watching, the other one's sleeping. The officer watches as Cook very slowly opens the car door and gets out. He stands in the door, sort of 1 foot on the ground and 1 foot on the car, looking around, just being sus as fuck. The constable that is watching wakes his sleeping partner up, and in that time, Cook is across the road to the bush, retrieving the gun. The cops leap over the fence, grab Cook from behind, slap one cuff on Cook, one cuff on the fence. They fucking got him.
Wow, that was well done, love.
Thank you.
Oh, what a roller coaster. Oh, we knew it was coming, but it was good. You did great. That was
what a relief, am I right?
Yeah.
So.
That would have been the biggest collar of their day, those films.
Incredible.
Oh, wow, that would have been intense.
Wow. So apparently the cops started noticing details about Cook immediately after calling it in. He's mumbling to himself. He has a cleft lip. His silk woman's gloves, which give him extremely soft hands. And they search him, finding a pair of woman's undies.
Sorry, he was wearing silk gloves?
He's wearing silk gloves. Yeah. He wears woman's silk gloves.
So it was. Getting a fingerprint was extremely rare then?
It was very rare. That's the only fingerprint they ever found of his.
Wow.
Yes. Remember, you might not remember in part one, because it was so fucking long ago, I told you about how he got caught a couple of times, and so then he taught himself to wear gloves and do things to not get caught. So from that point, he never left fingerprints.
Wow.
So they also find a newspaper clipping about a wedding that was on that day and underlined and an address written on it, the address of the wedding.
Oh, so he was going there to fuck up some newlyweds.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Cook is taken to the cop shop. You would fucking hope so.
Yeah.
Where every fucking cop in Perth is converging. They all want to get a look at this motherfucker.
Oh, wow. That would have been massive.
Huge. It's a good night to be a crook, though, because while they're all over there, you're over in Cottesloe breaking in houses. Cops start to recognize him. I don't know if you remember, but he was pretty well known to the local cops. Remember they called him Cookie?
Yeah.
They just thought he was a nickel and dime thief. He was just a petty cook. But at the time, they all knew who he was. He's bragging about the evening's crimes and all the petty crimes, but he's not commenting at all on any of the murders. He won't talk about it. He won't shut up about the, like, breaking and entering shit. But he denies all knowledge of involvement with Shirley's murder, claiming that he saw the gun when he pulled the van over to do something. I think he said the van was making a noise or something and he wanted to have a look at it. And he wanted to sell the gun. He saw it, wanted to sell it. The cops are dubious and continue with questioning, but aren't really getting what they want. They bring in Sergeant Mormon, who'd been dealing with Cox all the way back since he stole the money box from the church years and years ago. Did you have something to say?
Yeah, was he a Mormon?
I fucking hope so. Fuck, I hope so. So they had a kind of rapport. You know, they had a bit of a back and forth. They felt that might be useful.
Yeah, slip him up. Slip up.
Yeah. Hey, gone, Cookie. What's up, mate? Kind of, you know, chat. Yeah. He and Detective Barker, who's also well acquainted with Cook, are brought in to talk to him.
His nickname was Dog.
Oh, that's really good. I fucking hope it was. Yeah. I'm going to call him Dog from now on.
Or Tree.
Could have been Tree. They know, so they just come in and talk to him. They know well enough that if you let Cook talk for long enough, eventually he's going to spill the beans. He can't fucking help himself. But Cook's not as talkative as he usually is.
No.
He's not stupid, and he knows if he gives him anything on this, he's fucked. So they decide to go to his house. Sally, his wife, is pretty used to the cops rocking up, but she was not expecting them to be investigating a murder. And she tells him the truth. Good on you, girl.
So what did she tell him?
See, Cook had told the police that on the night of Shirley's murder, he'd been bowling and then he'd gone straight home. But Sally tells them he had not returned home until extremely late.
Good on you, girl.
Good girl. Cook's shook.
So he's obviously been told that your wife does not corroborate. Yeah. Corroborate?
Yeah, corroborate.
Corroborate? Did I say it right?
Collaborate? No, corroborate.
Corroborate.
Oh, we've said it too many times. It sounds weird now. She doesn't. She didn't agree. She didn't back up the story.
No.
So Cook's shook. He's like, no way, man. Sally is my wife and she'd never fucking dob me in kind of shit. So the cops bring her in. Sally's up front. Cook says to her, why did you tell him that? And she replies, because it's the truth, Eric, and you know it. Go, Sally.
She wanted him out of his life.
Fuck yeah, she's done with his shit.
She wanted him out of her life. Yeah. She knew he was no good.
So while this is going on, other officers are having a look at Cook's van. And there they find a .22 caliber cartridge case, which is sent in for ballistics testing and is quickly confirmed to have come from the rifle that killed Shirley MacLeod.
Boom.
Boom, baby. With this news, I love this forensic stuff.
Yeah.
Fucking love it, hey.
Unless it gets you in the shit, and then we hate it.
Then I'm not going to like it. I've not fucking done
anything. No, not you. I mean, like, individuals.
Don't point to yourself.
I'm pointing to me either.
With this news, Cook finally confesses.
Oh, does he?
He writes a statement. I mean, I've summarized it. There's a bit more to it, but I've generalized paraphrased it. I've paraphrased it to, like, make the story shorter. He writes a statement confessing to the murder, claiming that he had suffered a blackout at the time. Fuck off.
Yeah, I suffered a blackout and killed heaps of people.
Yeah, multiple times.
Well, I don't know because I had a blackout.
Doesn't matter anyway, because Cook is charged with willful murder.
Nice.
Perth breathes a sigh of relief. Cook's face is all over the papers and the news spreads that the nightmare is over. Naturally, this is massive fucking news and everyone's stoked as fuck.
Oh, you'd be down the tav.
Ugh. 100%.
You'd be having a frothy.
Leaving your doors unlocked.
Oh, back to how it was.
All his mates and acquaintances are pretty surprised. He was known as being pretty odd and a bit like, ick.
Yeah.
But no one suspected that he was capable of this shit. No. And, I mean, no one ever does. Everyone said that Ted Bundy was like the nicest guy.
Yeah.
Newsflash, he wasn't a nice guy. He fucking killed people.
Yeah.
You just thought he was a nice guy.
I never did.
Well, no, because you're very smart. So following his confession, the cops interrogate him in regards to the Australia Day shootings and they chuck him in the car and they drive him around Perth suburbs while Cook gives them every detail about his crimes.
So he realised he was balls deep and he just had to keep, this is my opportunity to...
He's sort of giving them
enjoy some, it for the last time.
Yeah, but here's the thing. He's confessed to some of it. He's confessed to Shirley.
Shirley's.
But he's not really giving them anything on the other stuff. Okay. Like, he's not confessed to Australia Day or anything like that yet. But they're kind of doing that thing where they want him to talk.
Yeah.
So they put him in the car and they drive him around.
Get him some food, make him feel comfortable.
So he gives them every detail about his crimes, including attacks, and he remembers every detail perfectly in, like, eerie, creepy, fucking perfect detail.
He catalogued
dates, times, how much money he stole from each house, even details like the colour of purses.
So it was never, it was obviously never ever about money or the object.
No.
It was about the act.
Yeah.
And him having something to remember. He want, you know, that's his highlight reel.
It's all about the thrill, I think, yeah. He gives them everything except any information on the shootings.
Yeah.
On that, he's giving Butkus. Though police had noticed a kind of subtle bad reaction when they drove past the houses where the shootings happened. Nothing solid to go on, but, like, they're just picking it up, picking up his body language and stuff like that. They're cops. It's their job. So next up on the tour, they go to the pub. But while they're there, the cops have a bit of a chat to Cook. They have a meal, like you said, have a beer.
So they had it. They so they took Cook. To so Cookie had a beer. Mm. He had a meal at the tav.
Yeah.
It's a weird.
Well, no, I think it's really smart.
Yeah, no, I like it.
Yeah, it's very smart. They basically have a one-on-one with him. Well, that's over a beer and over a palmy.
That's how donut. You know how cops and donuts are synonymous with one another.
Yes, well, I do. I know this, but please explain it to our listeners.
From what I understand, it's that when police officers were interrogating people or questioning people, questioning perps or whatever they call them, to help as a technique to help people talk and tell the truth, you bring in food that's easy to eat, like a donut, because they're cheap and easy and everyone loves them.
Mm-hmm.
And when people eat, they relax and loosen up and sink ships.
Exactly. I've also heard that it was a way of ascertaining how comfortable someone is.
Yeah.
So, like, it helps them decide whether or not you've done it as to whether or not you take a donut. I don't know if that's true, I do know that what you're saying is true.
I know. If I ever got pulled in to a cop shop and questioned about something, if I got called a cop shop, if I didn't do something or did do something, the outcome's the same. Mm-hmm. I'll probably eat all the donuts.
Oh, I'm eating the box. I'll eat the donuts.
Yeah, I'll definitely cut it out.
I'm very sorry my parents listened to this.
Played in the minors, never went pro, but yeah, I'd definitely eat all the donuts. And if there was pizza, I'd probably eat the pizza too.
That too.
Because,
what if there was a Marin sandwich?
Guilty as charged.
So basically they have a yarn with him over a pint and a palmy, and they say to him, look, mate, you're going to hang for the shooting of Shirley MacLeod. We've got you on this.
Yeah.
You're going to hang for it. You can either die a coward or you can man up and admit to the rest of the murders that you've committed.
The old chicken.
And give him the old man to man.
Yeah.
That talk seems to kind of sink in.
It doesn't mean anything, but it prompts a little bit of emotion.
It does, yeah. And I think Cook's got a bit of an ego to him. He doesn't want to be considered a coward.
Well, he's just been the most feared man in Perth.
Exactly.
He was the only person walking around not thinking that he could get fucked up because he was the one doing the fucker up.
Exactly. Yeah. So, as a pep talk in a pub will do, the pep talk sings in.
Pint and a palmy.
And Cook agrees to tell them everything. They take him back for another drive-through. And Cook tells them all the details about all of the murders.
Must have been a good feed.
Now that the dam has broken, Cook is way too happy to give every detail. I mean everything. He can remember all sorts of weird information, including exactly which light pole he'd been standing under when he threw the gun into the river after the mass shooting. Because of this information, the police are very easily able to retrieve the gun. Apparently what they did is they stood under the same light pole and threw a gun of the same make, and then used, looked at where it landed, and then used divers to search in that area.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It's fucking pretty cool, hey?
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
So during this fun-filled exploration...
So what river was that? Was that the Swan?
It would have been the Swan. Yeah. Surely, yeah. It must have been the Swan River. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So during this fun-filled exploration of Perth suburbs, they ask Cook why he did it. And he responds, I just wanted to hurt somebody. So my understanding is just a sad, weak little man. He got beat down his whole fucking life and he just wanted to do some beating.
Oh, Jesus.
It's pretty bad, hey? So he gets taken back to the cop shop after this and he writes out his confession in front of the cops and his wife, who must have been fucking horrified. She just thought he was a general fucking, low-life petty crook.
So she might not be about now, but her kids... And the kids would still be out and about now.
They are. So I advise caution. I imagine they've probably changed their names at this point.
Yeah.
So the next day he goes before the magistrate, who, weirdly enough, was the father of the girlfriend of John Sturkey, who was the 18-year-old who'd been sleeping on the front porch on Australia Day and Cook had killed him. So Perth isn't very big at this point. There's probably not a lot of magistrates. It's not totally unheard of that there'd be a connection. There'd be four. Exactly. It's not unusual that there'd be a connection, but it is interesting. So the magistrate had to seize the fallout of this murder and the effects on his daughter, and then he gets to be the one who remands Cook. Just a fun fact.
The full weight of everything that you could possibly...
Imagine having to put that aside and be non-biased.
Well, you're not going to be non-biased.
How could you possibly?
You're not going to be non-biased.
So after he's remanded, he goes on to give a lot more in-depth detail on his crimes, including the attacks on women that didn't end in murder. Like he hits them over the head.
Yeah.
Or he assaulted some women. So he confesses... I'm not including everything because there's actually fucking heaps. So he confesses all of these assaults, which the cops hadn't connected to the Australia Day murders at all. Like Penina Berkman and stuff like that. Like they and attacks like that, they hadn't connected any of these. It was all like, they're all like, whoa, are you fucking kidding me? Like,
yeah, wow.
We just thought you did this one thing. And then also adds on that there's not one, but two blokes in prison for his crimes.
So two guys have been put in prison.
Yeah, we talked about the other one in a first episode. Remember, he was a deaf mute?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. No doubt this was a massive surprise. So he confesses to those two crimes as well. And at this point, the cops decide to call it a day, probably because they all had fucking headaches.
Yeah.
Next day, they take Cook to the scene of the Rosemary Anderson hit and run murder. That's the one that John Button's in jail for. He gives every single detail in eerie accuracy, even able to take them to the park and point to the exact tree that he slammed the car into after the attack.
Far out. He was definitely...
He's fucking got it all locked away.
But he's giving it up.
Yeah.
He's not saving anything
for
later.
If he's going to go down, he might as well go down infamous.
Like. Yeah, but you want to hang on to something.
Apparently not. A full confession is written out on this with all the evidence he's provided. However, the cops have already got someone in jail for this crime. And they argue that the court had already said that the attacks happened a certain way, not the way that Cook had said. So Cook is saying, no, I definitely did it. I tell you, I'm telling you that I did it and this is how I did it.
No,
cops are saying, no, you didn't, because the court said it happened like this, not how you're saying it happened. So you didn't do it. Which is insanely frustrating.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting. You're right to drink your beer right now. They won't fucking have it. They make him retract his fucking mother-loving statement.
Oh, wow.
I know. And he writes another statement saying that he was mistaken. I fucking hate it.
Fucking justice system.
I know. So then the exact same thing happens. What? The exact same thing happens when he confesses to hitting and killing Jillian and they say, nope,
No, you didn't.
And they make him retract that shit too.
Back the fuck up. We got a dude in jail already doing
that. Yeah, we already got someone for that. So it can't be you. Fucking hell. So moving along, he confesses to all the hit and run crimes that I've told you about previously and some that I haven't told you about. This must have been so insane to the popo. He gives a written statement confessing to all the hit and runs. They investigate, confirm that it was him, close the file, and never tell the public.
Never tell the public.
They never release it. Wow. They tell the victim's families that they caught the guy, but that's it.
Well, probably because if everybody was shitting themselves, it was probably not too many people were doing any skullduggery at the time.
That's a good point.
So they probably thought, well, let's ride this gravy train.
Let's keep it quiet.
Let's leave him out there. Let's leave the memory of the chaos that he has committed to keep people in check.
That's a solid theory.
Maybe, maybe not.
So the trial comes up and, hey, callback time, he has Ken Hatfield as defense attorney.
Hattie.
Do you remember Hatfield?
I remember Hattie.
The Hat Man?
Hat Man.
That's Button's defense attorney.
Wow.
Small world, hey? Small Perth in the 60s.
Yeah.
So the case goes on to pump Cook for all the information that he has on his crimes. He still claims that he had suffered a blackout. But he goes, but I mean, honestly, like you can't say that you suffered a blackout and also be able to say what color the fucking purse was. You can't do both. You can't have perfect photographic memory of every crime and also say that you had a blackout. Like you fucking whatever. Anyway, so Cook, for all the information that he has on all of his crimes, still claims that he suffered a blackout, but he goes on to no doubt piss everyone off by confessing to more crimes while on the stand. So we've just taken a little break because, and it's still going, but we've decided to press on. So we live in a little country town, and when there's an emergency in one of the nearby country towns, there's a siren that goes off. It alerts the SES and the firefighters and all the emergency services, and you can hear it for miles around. And all the
dogs are howling. And
all the dogs are howling and all that.
Yeah.
It's still kind of going on in the background, so if you can hear it, I apologize.
It could have been an accident or a fire.
Yeah. It's just how they alert. It sounds a bit like Silent Hill.
Well, if you hear it and you're part of the SES,
if you're in the SES and you live nearby, or you're
part of the fire service, you hear it. That's when you jump in your car and get down
there. Everyone gets down there, which is fucking cool. They're heroes.
Yeah.
So while he's on the stand, I told you, he confesses to even more crimes. They hadn't pinned him for Penina and Lucy. And he tells them about that. He also says on the stand that he had confessed to the two hit and runs, and the police made him retract his statement. So there's probably a lot of really pissed off people in the in the audience. Anyway,
the gallery.
Thank you. Probably caused quite a bit of upset. So Penina and Lucy are added to his list of crimes, and the police will not budge on Rosemary and Jillian's hit and runs.
Wow!
No matter how Cook tries to convince them, they're like no. Even refusing to provide his confession to the defense until the trial has started, which, I mean, is pretty uncool, and I don't think that's allowed. You can't refuse to give evidence.
Oh, back then.
You're right.
It was, they're just assholes.
Yeah, for real. They've just decided, no, we're not fucking
Yeah, we made a mistake, but we're not going to own it.
No. Obviously, the main argument in the trial is not whether or not he did it. He clearly did it. He's saying he did it. It was more that he was he sane enough to be considered responsible for his crimes? That's the point of contention.
See, I think that's fucking bullshit. I don't know enough about the whole insane and not insane.
Well, I'm pretty sure now the deciding factor is if you knew well enough to cover it up, then you were not insane.
People that give that insane defense or come up with that insane defense have never been insane. So it's just looking from the inside. Like if you do a bad thing, you're a motherfucker and you got to be
If you can take steps to not get caught, for example, wearing gloves and wearing a mask so they can't see your cleft lip and stuff like that, you understand the consequences of your actions. You know enough to cover up the fact that you've done it and hide that crime.
And you hit a gun and you went back to get it.
You are not crazy.
Premeditated.
Yeah, exactly. There's premeditation involved. There's forethought. There's logic and understanding involved. He's not crazy. He's just an asshole.
Asshole.
Psychiatric examination had said that he was basically sane and understood right from wrong. The defense tried to rely heavily on Cook's fucked up childhood, many accidents, all the stuff that they tried to use to save him from the death penalty. Remember, he got all like the knocks on the head and stuff like that. He fucking went to hospital heaps and stuff. So they tried to use all that shit to be like, he's not
that bad.
He's not right in the noggin. Don't hang him. When Cook is questioned, he told the court of the powerful urges that he got to kill, saying that he didn't feel that the people that he killed were real people and that he was unable to stop himself from killing. There's a bit of a back and forth between doctors on the stand about whether or not he's sane, but like we've already said, if you take steps to prevent capture, like wearing gloves and a face covering, and that proves
hiding in shadows.
Yeah, that proves that you're sane and you know what you're doing and you understand your actions and you understand that there are consequences for them. You have put thought and planning into it. You are not insane. Apparently the jury agrees with me and you, I hope.
Yes.
And he's found guilty.
Yay.
Within just an hour.
Yep, no matter.
They pretty much walked in and were like, should we just finish our coffee while we're here?
Yeah.
Like, fuck it. The judge places the black cloth on Cook's head and sentences him to death by hanging.
Is that an actual thing he would have done?
Like, the black cloth?
Yeah,
that's what they do.
Well, they actually put a physical black cloth on someone's head.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's like a symbolic thing, yeah.
And then says...
We should talk a little bit more about the history of corporal punishment, but I'm pretty sure that they had like a black cloth that they would put on their heads. No, the judge puts it on his head.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think.
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure, and please, if you're listening, feel free to reach out and let me know if I'm wrong.
Involved, though.
You can find us on Facebook. But I'm pretty sure the judge puts a black cloth on his head, on the judge's head.
Okay.
Before he hands down a death sentence.
Yeah, so you know it's coming.
Symbolic gesture. Yeah, so you know it's coming. Like, Cook would have seen that and shit his pants. Maybe. Okay. I like to think he did. I hope that he did. Right, so he sentences him to death by hanging. Cook decides to accept the verdict and he does an appeal. He accepts that he deserves the punishment handed down. His lawyers then set to work attempting to free the two men that were in jail for his crimes.
Nice.
John Button and Darryl Beamish. Cook writes again confessions to both murders, saying that he wants to clear his conscience before he's executed. These confessions are long and deeply detailed and full of things that only the killer would have known, like what colour Rosemary's handbag was.
Wow, he's got a great memory.
Things like that. Yeah, really impressive. That sounds wrong. Mm. A hearing is set up and both men are approved for new trials. And this sets back Cook's execution date, which he's actually not that happy about. He's kind of just keen to get it over and done with at this point. But he's really worried that John and Daryl are going to suffer for his crimes.
Yeah. I'd really like to know the psyche of that. Like,
yeah, like
because he can. He didn't seem to care whose lives he destroyed.
No, he didn't.
So he
but he didn't want these men to.
But the
pay
fallout,
for his
the fallout of the stuff he did, has affected these guys' lives deeply.
Do you think it's more of wanting the credit for his
crimes? Yeah, he's probably vain. He might be vain about it. Yeah.
He's obviously after the infamy. I wonder if there's some of that coming into play.
Yeah.
He says he's also worried that John and Daryl are going to seek revenge on his family. A fear that he has voiced many times, which, I mean, that's not a real concern, surely. The appeals, however, don't go great. It's thought that they reckon that Cook is just trying to stay his execution.
Okay.
He's questioned about his other hit and runs, but in confessing and retracting, he's seen as untrustworthy, and the appeals are dismissed.
Really?
He was deemed a liar who just wanted the infamy, and John and Daryl are to stay in prison.
Oh, wow.
The big day comes around, and it's time for Cook to be hanged. It's set for October 26, 1965, and Cook is fine. He's ready. 3 days prior to his hanging, he talks to his reverend, saying the only thing on his conscience was the two men in jail for his crimes. He swears on the reverend's Bible he was the one that committed the murders. Parliament attempts to stay the execution again in the hopes of a retrial. But it's the actual day before.
Yeah.
And it dies in the ass.
Okay.
So, the 26th. Cook wakes up in his cell.
That's a dollar.
On the 26th or waking up?
No, 26 is a dollar.
26 is a dollar. He's talking about darts, folks. So, it's 6 a.m. and Cook wakes up in his cell. His police escorts take him to the shower block. He's given a fresh set of clothes and taken to the holding cell behind the gallows, where he chats lightly with the guards and his reverend for about 10 minutes. When it's time to go, Cook says to the Rev, "I swear before Almighty God that I killed Anderson and Brewer." So he's really, like, not stoked on these guys paying for his crimes, which I find so bizarre.
Well, I think in that, though, he said he owned up to it early. They didn't believe him. He owned up it again, didn't believe him. He brought it up in his court trial. They didn't believe him, and he kept bringing it up. And he's probably like, come on.
Yeah, he's probably
I've told you over and over again. I've given you details that nobody, that the guys you put in prison wouldn't even know these
You
details.
Should have everything you need at this point. Like,
yeah. But because whoever made the mistakes to put these innocent men in prison, it's just covering up for them.
Mm. Absolutely. The executioner then takes him to the gallows, where a white hood is placed over his head and the noose is pulled over his neck. In less than a minute...
Could you imagine that feeling?
Whenever I write one of these stories about a corporal punishment, a public execution, a hanging or whatever, I always try to imagine what that moment is like.
Because like, for
I
me,
can't help but do it.
Like, if you have to go in for surgery, the day before surgery, or the day before going, if you don't like going to the dentist like me, the day before you go into the dentist or going to surgery or something happening, you know, there's that trepidation. You know, you're not there.
It's like something might happen.
You know, but you know it's going to happen. You know that this is going to happen. You don't know what it's going to be like.
This is it.
You don't know how it's going to feel. You don't know what it's going to feel like before, during, after. And there's that fear, you know, like, there's that fear before you go
if
in.
If you say you're completely comfortable with it, like Cook said he was fine.
Yeah, and everybody's felt felt that somewhat.
That must be like that final moment of like, that's the noose around my neck.
Yeah, the noose, the white like, sheet going over your neck, like that
shit.
Neck, like that time. And especially if you have beliefs, you know, like if you have
like,
certain beliefs.
Am I going to have to now stand before God and tell
him? Yeah, if you
believe.
I mean,
those are not my beliefs, but they were his.
If you believe in Christianity or whatever belief you have, or do you know, if you're an atheist, you think that, you know, when you die, that's just it. So, but all this stuff would be, you've had time to think about it enough, but
yeah,
you know, when it's fucking go time, you're sitting there, white sheet over, like, your head, noose fuck, around your neck.
I'm going to die right now.
You're pissing shit yourself. Like, what happened? What?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know, right? It's pretty big. Like, I always think about that moment. Not in, like, empathy. I don't empathize with Cook.
No, certainly not.
But, like, I just find it.
Try and seek to understand what.
Yeah.
But
it's a frightening thought. It's a very haunting thought.
And nobody would be able to tell you.
Yeah.
What that's like.
No. Well, I mean, they can't. They're dead. So less than a minute after the executioner puts the white hood on, Cook is dead. There's a small funeral with some inmates and the reverend and the gravedigger. Cook is lowered into a grave which had been dug decades previously for a Martha Rendell. But we're going to talk about her another day.
Okay.
The Rev goes to see Sally Cook to tell her about the funeral because nobody else fucking had. That's his wife. Yeah. No one told him. No one told her. And he tells her about Cook's last words, the confession. And I would have been like, fuck that dude.
Yeah.
His last words weren't like, tell Sally I love her. No. Dick.
Well, would you want to be loved by such
a man? No. No. I don't know.
Would you want a man?
I can't imagine what their relationship must have been
by
like.
By this time, she obviously would have to, you know, you would think you would despise him.
Definitely, especially the more you hear about his crimes.
So like, wouldn't him, if his last words were saying, I love you, by somebody that you despise, it would just be so, it would be the opposite to,
you're right.
It'd be the opposite to the words.
Yeah, you're right. John Button is released on parole in December 1967.
So how long has he been in prison for?
So
early 60s, like 62, 63?
A few years.
So he's been there for 4 or 5 years, maybe. Yep. Wow.
He tries to put his life back together, but it takes him a while to recover from the trauma of what he's endured. And plus, everybody knows who he is.
Yeah.
He finally gets a job, he gets married, and after a near-death experience in a car accident, he turns to religion. And it helps him to believe that everything he has endured is part of God's plan. Estelle, these are all clip, like epilogues kind of thing. Estelle Blackburn releases a book called Broken Lives in 1998. It's a massive hit. A member of Parliament reads that book and enters a motion to appeal for Button and Beamish that night.
Wow.
Finishes the book, picks up the phone. Button and Beamish get a fucking appeal. They are both granted new appeals. And in February 2002, it is ruled that there has been a miscarriage of justice and Button's case is quashed. Beamish gets his turn in 2004. He's fucking 64 years old.
So he stayed in prison that long?
Yes, he did.
To 2004?
Yes, he did.
Fuck.
It's fucking horrible, hey?
So he spent his whole life, most of his life, in prison.
Such a miscarriage of justice.
So Button got out early.
Button got out before.
But Beamish stayed till he's in his 60s.
Yep.
Somebody wrote a fucking book in 1998.
And, like, shone light on it.
And then someone in Parliament read it. So what happened? What happened to Button? Like, what was the outcome for Button? Because he's already been released.
Well, Button gets released. He puts his life back together. We'll come back to Button.
Okay. Beamish, though.
Beamish is granted a payout in 2011.
He's in his 60s.
Well, he was in his 60s in 2004.
Okay.
When he gets finally released. In 2011, he gets granted a payout. So what's that math, Blue? You do it real quick.
What was he?
2004, he was 64.
2004, he was 64. And then there's 6, 7 years on top of that. So he is now 71.
Fucking hell. So he's getting a payout from the WA government. At the time, it's... Are you ready to be mad again?
No, why?
It's $4,025.
Are you sure that's that right? Are you sure it's $4,000?
Yep.
Or not 4 million?
Pretty sure.
Not 4 million?
If I'm wrong, I'll retract my statement.
Or 400,000? 4,000.
I might have fucked it up. I do fuck up numbers. All right, so but I remember 4,000, being mad about how little it was.
400,000, 400,000, or 4 million.
Could have been $40.25.
Yeah, wow.
I fuck up numbers all the time.
Doesn't matter anyway. Kind of my thing. Goddamn, man.
And he gets an official apology.
Who gives a fuck?
I know, right? Like, give me back my life. I got one and you fucking took it.
He
did
all right,
though.
He's lived in prison all right. He obviously looked
after himself. You fucking didn't get much of a chance. So they hope that the money will help him to have a comfortable retirement. Button goes on to become the head of the West Australian Innocence Project.
Wow.
Which helps wrong. Have you ever heard of the Innocence Project?
No.
So the Innocence Project is, and there's one like, there's chapters all over the world. They help people that are wrongly convicted get appeals and get out.
Awesome.
By proving that they were wrongly convicted. It's amazing. What a beautiful way to take this fucking horrible trauma that's happened to you and do something with it. That's amazing.
Mm.
Well done, mate. And on that note, Bluey, we're done.
Wow.
That is the story of the Netherlands Monster or the Nightcaller, which is weird because that's Richard Ramirez's name. But so that's the story of Eric Edgar Cook.
Wow.
Everyone go read Broken Lives. It's got way more detail in it than I can fit into 3 episodes. I mean, there's fucking heaps more. You think that was rough? There's a bunch more assaults that I couldn't even fucking fit in. How do you feel, Bluey?
I really enjoyed this last installment.
You're sick.
I didn't enjoy the detail. I just think that we've done it on a Friday afternoon with a couple of beers. And
yeah, it's probably a good way to do it.
It's hummed along nicely. The information is really nice, well received, well read, love.
Thank you.
The whole series has been great. Yeah, well done.
Yeah, so what did you make of this deep dive? And
wow.
Had you ever heard of the Netherlands Monster before? No. You'd never had?
No, certainly not.
Also, I forgot to add, he's the last person hung in Western Australia.
He was the last person hung in Western Australia. That's a pretty big deal.
Do you remember who the last 3-part deep dive was?
Yeah, the chick that was
Ronald Ryan.
Who?
Last person hung.
Ronald Ryan.
Yeah.
This
there's a pattern, is what I'm trying to tell you. There's a pattern forming.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically what I'm trying to say is that each season I'm going to try and do a 3-part or at least a deep dive into the last person hung in each state.
Oh, wow. So last time, where were they hung?
It was Ronald Ryan. Where and was now he hung? We're talking about...
So where was Ronald Ryan hung? Do you remember?
Or no, South Australia? I don't remember.
Anyway, this old mate...
Yeah, no, Australia. We're not talking about Ronald Ryan right now.
No, West Australia, last person hung in Western Australia. Wow.
Yeah, so Eric what Henry Cook story. Was the last person hung in Western Australia.
Yeah.
Yes. And there it is. I remember hearing about Eric Edgar Cook when I was quite young. Can't remember who. Pretty sure my mum made mention of him. That might not be true. Sorry for dropping it in there, mum. But I'd heard about him in terms of being, of having broken into a woman's house and killing her with a lamp cord.
Yep.
So I'd heard about that murder. But I don't remember exactly how old I was, and I might have been eavesdropping onto the adults.
Possibly.
Maybe. I don't know. Anyway, Blue, so you'd never heard of the Netherlands Monster. No. That really surprises me. I mean, I grew up in WA, so yeah, I heard of him. Yeah, that's surprising to me. Well...
Thank you very much.
Do you have anything further to add? Are you okay?
A lot of emotions have been experienced over the last hour and however long this has been.
This has been a long one. Yeah. Shall we wrap this shit up?
Let's wrap it up.
Let's stick a fork in it.
And pull it out. If the potato drops straight off, she's good to go.
You can mash it.
See you next time.
Bye.